The Carl Pearson Prize for Contemporary Research Contribution is one of the biggest awards in the statistical community. Given out every 2 years by the International Statistical Institute, the award recognizes research published sometime in the last 30 years that has had, quote, profound influence on statistical theory, methodology, practice, or applications, end quote. The work of the latest winner is the subject of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. Joining me in the studio are regular panelists John Baylor, Chair of Miami Statistics Department, and Richard Campbell, former Chair of Media, Journalism, and Film. Our guest today is Yoav Benjamini, the Nathan and Lily Silver Professor of Applied Statistics at Tel Aviv University. Benjamini is also the 2019 winner of the ISI's Carl Pearson Prize for his work developing the concept of the false discovery rate. Yoav, congratulations and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
You're being recognized for a paper that was published in 1995 and that's been cited more than 50,000 times and that has clearly had an impact on the field. How did this concept of false discovery rate come about, and how did you end up writing about it?
Well, that's an interesting story. The issue of addressing simultaneous selective inference, which is the technical technical term I'll explain shortly, it comes up when you have you're facing a problem of inference, which is not okay. So, the question of addressing multiple inferences in the form of having to put a many confidence interval and then choose the most promising one, or looking at many groups and making comparisons between them and then choosing the largest outcome with the smallest outcome and making this comparison. All of these questions raise the problem that our regular statistical tool fails to keep their properties. So if we allow ourselves, if we do a test of a hypothesis comparing a drug to a control, and we allow ourselves a 5% error of making a statement about a discovery or a rejected hypothesis in the statistical terminology, then we know that there is a 5% chance that we are in error, even if we decide that there is a discovery. But suppose you're doing, you're facing 20 such potential discoveries. Now, well, on the average, you will find one which is within this error. So the question is, how do you cope? How do you keep the original properties of a statistical procedure when facing a large number of potential outcomes? And this is not a theoretical question. If you look at any drug discovery experiment, and you have usually one or two major measures, or they're called endpoints, measures of success, of efficacy of the drug. But on top of that, you have nowadays dozens of other indications of the success of a drug. Well, let me give one example. Suppose there is a drug that is given, and it's given in four different doses, and then it is given with another drug, with currently used drug and another one. And then the efficacy is measured not only 5 years, as I said before, but also half a year after, and then survival, in the long-term survival, and then progression-free if it is cancer, and so on. And you can easily accumulate dozens of indications of the success of the treatment. And if you then pick up those handful which show success and treat them as if they are pure and innocent, then you lose the statistical properties. You have to protect against that.
So with multiple comparisons, I mean, like the example that you just said, if you wanted to compare seven groups, there were 42 pairs of group comparisons you could make. But false discovery didn't catch fire at that point. There was more recent technology and testing that really seemed to be where your ideas of false discovery caught on and really have been applied. Can you talk a little bit about those?
No, the point is that at that time, the way to handle that one, and that was suggested by Tukey and others, the way to do it was to have a very strong control. Mm-hmm. I called it panic control, to control the probability of making even a single error. Mm-hmm. And that resulted with a very strong requirement on a proof, on a valid proof. And for us, for Yossi Hochberg and for me, I wasn't involved in working in the area. For Yossi Hochberg and for me, the problem came up when he was first involved in a research about a drug related to drug pressure. And it was a quality of life questionnaire with more than 100 items. And, there was a joint score, and that was a single indication of success, but also you wanted to say, well, does the drug improve, reduces headaches? Does it improve other things? So the question, the problem really was that using any of the methods, and Yossi was one of the designers of methods that controlled the Hochberg methods. He was one of the designers of problems that exactly controlled the probability of making even one error. We ended up short-handed. I mean, it didn't provide any indication for success. So we started to do some other thing. At that same time, there was a paper that discussed a graphical method for estimating the number of null hypotheses from a graph of the p-values. The point was that you could use the bigger data in order to estimate what is really the problem you're facing. Because if you understand that, okay, you are facing 100, but about 50 of them are real effects, then you have to protect, mm-hmm. to offer less protection than otherwise. So this is where we stopped before we started with the false discovery rate.
Yeah. Talk about that.
The point was that essentially, after reading a paper by Zorich, argued really, you know, the fact of false discovery, but he actually said, you know, you don't need to control. He was not talking about control. He was talking about errors. And he's saying, let's look at the relative errors, and that is the number of discoveries, the expected number of discoveries out of the discoveries. And we captured this and formulated it into a new concept. And this is the false discovery rate. Instead of just controlling the number of errors or the probability of making even one error, we control the proportion of the errors among the discoveries. Mm. That is, it becomes a ratio, and we are trying to control only that. Now, that means that if we make many rejections, we allow errors. And that was the issue. Mm-hmm. We were more lenient than right. the usual panic approach that that happened. Mm-hmm. And so the objection for many of our reviewers was that here we hamper the pureness of the protection that the usual mm-hmm. approach held. Do not allow any error with a probability of 0.05 okay. or any other chosen probability. And that's why that was caused the problem. I mean, mm-hmm. Some people appreciated it, some not. Interestingly, once we got very, very quickly the result, and I sent it to John Tukey, who was my advisor at Princeton, where I did my PhD, but of course was the main one. And I thought that somebody already did it, and He just complained about the fact that the pages weren't numbered. Made no comment.
That sounds like a professor.
So a month later, we submitted the paper. That was 89. And as you and as you mentioned, it took us three journals and almost and 5 years, not for the original journal, original idea, but the truncated idea. That is, as I noted, we had a method of estimating the number of true null hypotheses, and that's useful in methods for controlling the false discovery rate. We didn't include that, and that the result that was published in 95 was the Benjamini-Hochberg procedures, which is non-adaptive in nature. And I think one interesting note to understand how statistics have changed is the fact that in the first review that we got, we were asked to do a simulation.
Okay.
And we were asked, we were questioned about the concept that we had, and we changed it a bit, and we did a simulation. In that second version that we submitted to the same journal, we did a simulation for 4, 8, 16, and then 64 size of a problem, hypothesis being tested.
Yes.
And we got complaints from the reviewer. How can someone think about doing 64 tests of hypotheses? It's enough to do, to stop at 20. Nobody does more than that.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and today we're talking with Tel Aviv University's Yoav Benjamini, winner of the 2019 Carl Pearson Prize from the International Statistical Institute. Yoav, this paper was published in 1995. We've talked a bit about the problems you faced in getting it published, and it's been cited again more than 50,000 times. When did you and your co-author maybe realize that this was something that was picking up steam? You know, after all this struggle of getting it published, and when you saw people start picking it up, was there a moment where you were like, oh, yes, this is something that really is going to have the impact we want it to have on the field?
Yeah. Well, 95 wasn't the end of the road. The original paper was published in 2000. That took another 5 years. But by that, I knew from the beginning that it's something to work. I had problems with the concept of controlling the probability of having even one error. Because how can I, as a statistician, control the probability of making any error throughout my lifetime at the 0.05? That's just impossible. Now, controlling the false discovery rate is feasible, even if you do it in each study separately. So I had a good feeling that we're on the right on the right road. But I think that there were a few people who really made an impact on that, and a few areas in science who made an impact on that, on its acceptance. The first is a visit by visit by Donohoe that came after a collaborator of mine, Felix Abramovich, came from sabbatical, brought in the idea of wavelets. And actually, with wavelets analysis, we started to show that it makes sense to threshold wavelets coefficient with FDR, with the BH approach. Then Dave Donohoe spent a sabbatical in Israel in 94 and got the idea, liked it very much, and then went back to Stanford and talked about it. And people around Stanford, most notably Brad Efron and his students, and Jonathan Taylor, and then other people in the world, and so on. People got interested in that. And essentially at the same time in the 2000, around the year 2000, the number of genes that were analyzed for differential gene expression reached sort of the area of 2000, 4000.
Wow.
And suddenly this idea of false discovery rate control in this, in problems of this size became a very practical solution. So two things happened jointly. Now, the work with Donohoe, with Dave, and then with Ian Johnston, and with Felix Abramovich, that continued through 95, 96, 97. Johnston talked about it in Walden Lectures in 97. The paper wasn't published until much later, but it had a big impact because it was a very theoretically founded thought. Concepts like testimation came up. That is, if you're facing a big problem, use FDR control for living out the coefficients which don't pass the threshold of significance. Strangely enough, significance makes sense. Just leave them out and estimate all the other parameters. That's good enough in theoretical, with theoretical justification, reaching in sparse problems really the right rate of asymptotic optimality and constant and so on and so forth. So that gave also a push to the interest, to the theoretical interest in the false discovery rate.
So with gene expression, with thousands of genes being studied, you know, it's easy to imagine, you know, the number of comparisons that one might make. I was reading about some of the background material that you had also sent out, where there was noted that FDR has been used in astronomy and brain research and psychology. Yeah. Could you talk about a few of the examples in these different areas other than gene expression where FDR has proven to be very useful?
Sure. One of the things that I enjoy is working myself in this field. I've been working in animal behavior, in meteorology, in brain research, member of the Sagol School for Neuroscience. So my interests are also in applied areas of statistics and other sciences. And one of the nice things about FDR is that really these problems have given rise to development of the FDR methodology. Mm. So, for instance, our interest in climatological areas, together with my ex-students and now colleague Dani Cutielli, brought up interest of dealing with dependency. And that was back in the 90s, our original work. And then dependency because of medical research brought a very important work on the properties of our procedures under the positive dependency. In brain research, especially fMRI, where you image the brain while the subject is functioning, and you try to locate areas of activation. So this functional MRI areas of research brought a problem that actually there are many voxels, and you can do inference on individual points in the brain. But you're actually interested in islands of activities, in regions of activity. And so suddenly it's not only the individual points, but cluster of points. Mm-hmm. Which are kind of interest. And Genovese and Wasserman and their collaborators were interested in that, and Nicholas and others. And it brought the need to do, the first need to do hierarchical analysis of fault discovery rate, first at the level of clusters and then going down into inside it. Later on, trying to correlate regions in the brain with SNPs, with locations on the genome. That brings up huge problems. I mean, this is about 500,000 SNPs, and there are some 50,000 voxels in the brain where you measure the size. And when you check the association, the old potential association between the two, you reach the 13 billion different reports, but you need new tools and work with Marina, my students. We started with building tools for hierarchical problems, and they rely back on problems that Dani Cutielli worked by himself and with us on general theoretical trees of hypotheses, and how do you make full discovery rate control along layers, on outside nodes, on things that are scientifically of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Our most recent work with Chiara Sabati, Marina and Peterson, deals with microbiome data, and then brings up a tree, a very deep tree that is constructed out of the biological tree of species, families, and so on and so forth. So each, as we enter into more and more interesting problems, we have to build up, based on the original concept, but build up new methodology and sometimes modify the concepts as well.
So one of the things that you're bringing up here is the complexity of this, all of this kind of research in science and statistics. And one of the jobs that journalists have to do is to try to explain this to a general audience. So you've got a couple of journalists sitting here. Do you have any sort of both frustrations with journalists and tips for journalists who need to do a good job in explaining the complexity of some of the work that you've been involved in and some of the things that you've just been talking about?
You're talking to me. You're asking this question on a bad day because I've been involved over the last almost a year in running a committee for design strategy for data sciences in the Israel Academy. And today came out a description of what we did in the local paper.
All
completely, not only not in focus, but simply wrong. So,
So what did the journalists do wrong?
Most seriously, the question. I think that, strangely enough, I think I learned from one journalist. People who are working on multiplicity, like Tuki, were other peoples here, were interested in the problem of selection. The fact that you are selecting particular inferences changes the statistical properties of what you do. Mm-hmm. It's the selection. Mm-hmm. And the way to deal with them was in terms of simultaneous inference and so on. I think simultaneous inference is a difficult concept for journalists. I think the false discovery rate is more intuitive. That is, distributed. I say, I'm checking 130 types of foods. People who take more of them or less of them, and see how does it affect their getting cancer, specific cancer. And then I say eight of them seem to cause, okay? So I have eight discoveries. Now, false discovery rate, people understand, you know, how many of them might be false because I'm never sure when I'm doing statistical analysis. So in that sense, it's a very... I think I'm asking a journalist now. I think it is a reasonable concept. I'm not asking about the family, what define a family, and so on. I have, you know, I'm presenting you discoveries, and I want to tell you what is my assessment of the proportion of false discoveries here. I can't tell you exactly, but maybe I can tell you on the average in expectation. So in that sense, I think it is something which is communicable.
Yes, I understand that.
So, you know, there's been a recent discussions about reproducibility and about the American Statistical Association has a p-value statement. There have been conferences, there have been special issues of journals that are talking about this. Can you reflect on what you think about this issue of p-values and the role of p-values in inference?
Yes, because it's very much related to what I was talking about, the issue about the issue of selective inference. I think that that the whole attack on the p-value is not justified. And in fact, there is a retreat from that, because the p-value is our purest defense against being fooled by randomness, in the sense that it needs minimal assumption. And in fact, if you are conducting an experiment, a well-designed experiment, you can assure that the assumption will hold. There's no other statistical method that can guarantee it. I mean, if you're doing an estimator, you assume some model outside where you can assure it. So in that sense, there is no reason to attack the p-value. Now, the p-value was singled out, first of all, because there are some problems with misinterpretation and so on. But that's true about any other method, about confidence interval, likelihood ratio, and so on. Mm-hmm. The point was that it was clear when the problems of replicability and reproducibility started, it was clear that statistics is part of the problem. There is being open, there is being the effect of being open, and so on and so forth. But the statistical methods were part of that. And there was a void, and the void was entered by people outside the profession, and it was easy to attack the p-value, especially since, you know, in statistics, there are the Bayesians, there is the Bayesian religion, and the likelihood religion, and so on and so forth. And that's an opportunity to attack the p-value. But that's not what happened, what's really behind it. And it's not using a threshold like p less than 0.05 or p less than 0.005. There are two basic, in my view, there are two basic problems that underline all statistical problems, and one of them has changed in recent years. And the fact is selective inference. And the second one is hunting out the real uncertainty that assures replicability. And I'm talking about replicability, not reproducibility, because replicability is the property of the result of a study, and it can only be established by replication, but we can try to enhance the replicability. And one of the obstacles to replicability is the fact that people don't address selective inference. The example that I gave, genomics, brain research, and so on, people started to address the problem where the number where the size of the problems that addressed can close to 1,000 or past 1,000. In QTL analysis, it was around 700. In gene expression, it was 4,000. When you reach 4,000, people realize that they have to address selective inference. But in many areas, like medical research, which is not for regulatory, they're very careful about selective inference. But the regular papers that are being published in the best of the medical journals, like the New England Journal of Medicine, on the average, on a sample took of 100, there are 27 different inferences made. In experimental psychology, the average is around 70. It goes from, if I'm not mistaken, from 6 to 700 you can find in papers. And there, people don't address selective inference. Mm-hmm. Don't address, I mean, if they do in a minimal way, but not appropriately. And so, and this is something that has changed. It has changed because science has been industrialized some 20 years ago with the invention of tools like genomics and proteomics and brain imaging and recording tools in psychology and so on. It is so easy to collect so many things. Passing in epidemiology from taking out the patient's records to taking them out of the computer. I mean, it's so easy to collect the information, and slowly the size increased and people didn't pay attention to that. So selective inference, which is not addressed, and this is true by all properties, confidence interval, p-values, likelihood ratio, credence intervals, all of these suffer from this problem.
Well, Yoav, I think we could probably talk about this all day long. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us.
You're very welcome, and I'm happy to share my ideas with you. And with the audience.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, and the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.